You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 107, with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and myself, Chris Webster. Today, Alan tells us about an indexical shape, the encapsulated cross. All right, welcome to the Rock Art Podcast. This is your sometimes co-host, Chris Webster, talking, because I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Garfinkel today. Alan, how's it going?
You know, it's going well. It's been an interesting day. Where are you located right now?
I am on the Oregon coast, Central Oregon coast.
Oh, my word. Yeah. What's the weather like there?
The high was 59 today.
Oh, my words. Cool. Well, I'm here in Bakersfield, California, my home away from home. And we've had some good weather. It's been cooler. It's not been that hot. So we've been blessed a little bit. So it's good. It's good. So the continuing digital, you know, connection always amazes me. No matter where we are,
we have
a robust way of communicating. It's great.
And before we really get into the topic today, I just want to let our audio listeners know, our podcast listeners know, that there is a video component to this. I'm going to be dropping this on the Archaeology Podcast Network YouTube channel. And if all goes well, Dr. Garfinkel's YouTube channel as well. We'll link to those down in the show notes once it gets up. Also, for our video listeners, anybody who did happen to find this on YouTube, you can find this podcast by just searching the Rock Art Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, all the different places. Or you can go over to arcpodnet.com/rockart and you can find it there. So if you're interested in the audio version only, then you can do that. Otherwise, we are going to try to include a presentation that Alan has to go along with this in the show notes, and it should be along with the video as well, if all goes well. So we'll see how that goes. Anyway, and this is the first time we've actually done video with the Rock Art Podcast. It's through our platform that we record with called Zencaster, and it kind of just does all the work for us, which is pretty great. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. We're just trying something new here. I think with that, Alan, we'll get into talking about a particular rock art image, if you will, that has special meaning.
So I've been thinking about this for quite a while and wanting to discuss a particular symbol that is pan-North America and also in some ways pan-Mesoamerica. And it's called the encapsulated cross. It's called the encircled cross. It's an abiding symbol of Native American cosmology, and it has intricate connections to a lot of history, religion, and the values and themes of the nature of Native American, what would you call it? Native American religion, but also Native American value systems and heritage. So all of the above.
Before we get too deep into this, why don't you describe what one of these looks like? Because I'm imagining like crosshairs in a rifle or something.
That's exactly what it looks like.
Okay.
If you put a cross on a piece of paper, the intersections of a vertical and a horizontal line, and you encircled them with a circle. That's all it is. Okay. It's an encircled cross. Now, you would think that something that simple would not have much gravitas, but it certainly mm-hmm. does. In Mesoamerica, in indigenous cosmology, amongst what we call the Nahuatl, there's a term for this thing. It's called Nahua-Olin, which means four movement.
Okay.
And there's many names for this. It's a quatrefoil. It's a quinsunk. And it means perpetual movement of the universe.
Okay.
It means integrating and reintroducing the energy and infinite motions of the cosmos. Hmm. And if you look at the Aztec codices, they actually have a symbol, which is called a Nahui-Olin.
Okay.
And this represents the fifth age, the fifth sun. It's a deep time Uto-Aztec and sacred narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It links with one of the most important creation stories that you can have for a culture.
Okay.
You know, so it's all that and much more. The story goes for the Aztecs that all the gods had gathered to sacrifice themselves and create a new age. The world and the sun had already been created, but it would only be through sacrifice that the sun would be able to be set into motion and time. And we had these five sacrificial volunteers that were going to do this. One of them would have to jump into the fire, but none of them really wanted to do that. But the smallest and humblest of them was the one that decided to jump into the flames and was transformed into the sun and set the sun into motion through his sacrifice.
Wow.
But as they leaped into the fire and became the sun didn't have enough momentum or energy to move in the heavens. So they had to assemble all four or five of these volunteers or pilgrims to help lift up the sky and move the sun into the heavens so it could perform its regular movements.
Wow. Okay.
So what we think about constantly for those that are connected to the celestial movements of the sun and the moon and the stars is when the sun finishes up its travels, which is at the winter solstice sunrise, it stops in the heavens. Its movement stops. It sits in the same place for several days. And that is what's called the winter solstice. And during the winter solstice was when the several groups inaugurated or commemorated this phenomenon. And they would have what's called the new fire ceremony. And the new fire ceremony is when they would charge up and get the movement going again and continue the world and its natural cycles, keep the cycles going. That was something that was considered to be one of the most sacred of times. And that was December 21st or 22nd. And since it was a pagan holiday, Euro-Americans decided that that would be a good date for Christmas. And so they created a ceremony that would vie with the pagan holiday. And so December 25th is now our Christmas holiday.
Right. Wow. There you go. So how does this all lead back to the encapsulated cross then? And when you say cross too, you said a horizontal and a vertical line. You know, when you say cross, I imagine like a Christian cross, but do we mean an offset cross like that with two different length lines or more of a plus sign?
More of a plus sign. That's what it's called. It looks like a plus sign. And when I went to my Catholic church today and I looked up, they had an exact replica of this symbol with a circle around it and a plus sign.
Wow.
So it's still there to this very day. It takes a central place in many churches and many representations. They call it St. Andrew's Cross, They call it a Maltese cross. What else do they call it? A four-petal flower. It's a four-week butterfly. What else? It's the quintessential symbol of what's called the fifth era. Now, this symbol is sometimes called an Olin, O-L-L-I-N. It's the glyph of movement and transformation. Now, there's a flower that grows in Mexico. It has four petals and a center, and that's considered to be the equivalent representation of this Olin. Now, if we are looking or wondering about Catholicism and Christianity and how that sort of interdigitates with the native world, on the tilma of Juan Diego, in the representation of the Virgin of Guadalupe, over her womb is a Nahui Olin, a quinsunk. It's exactly the same picture. It's this four-petaled flower with the center in it. It's a symbolic way that the Indians understood that she's the mother of the sun god. The sun god was in her womb, and he was the sole author and giver of life. This was sometimes, you know, identified as the flower of the sun.
Okay.
Now, all of this is interesting and of relevance, but if you look on the rock art in California, in the Great Basin, all throughout the eastern Mojave Desert, and even into Southern California, you're going to see this symbol again and again and again.
Yeah.
It is something that is, I guess, part and parcel of the cognitive map of the universe of the native people. Even though it's also part of Christian symbolism, I believe it's more popular and more central to native people.
Yeah, well, probably older too, I would imagine.
Much older. Much older. I think it goes back thousands and thousands of years, and I bet if we identified it, it probably is part and parcel of some of the earliest symbols that we might have going back 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years or more.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, it's a relatively simple symbol to construct, so that helps, right? And like you said, it has a lot of meaning depending on what you look at it, you know, how you look at it and who you are. So
if you think about this symbol, right? It is related to and similar to, if not one and the same, as what's called the broken cross.
Okay.
It's this circular symbol, cross in a circle. It looks like a counterclockwise swastika. It's or whirling logs. And you see them. I've seen them several times in the Cosos, and they're all over baskets from the Southern California Indians. And also, it is depicted in the Navajo language as well. So it's sometimes called the cosmic cross, the solar cross. And when you see these four parts, that represents, of course, the four basic elements of life: air, wind, fire, water, earth.
Right.
Air, wind represents life. Fire is warmth and light. Water is sustenance of life, and earth, of course, is that terrestrial plane where the humans abide, and that's provided with the life-giving plants and animals. Amazing.
Okay. Yeah, so that is amazing.
For the Hopi, they have something they call the Tekwa wheel, and that's definitely the same element. And it means, together with all nations, we protect both land and life and hold the world in balance. Okay. That's what the Tekwa wheel is all about. So with this Nahui Olin, it's a symbol of movement. It represents the congregation of and generation of energy, but it's also diametrically opposed. It attracts and repels at the same time. It's in constant movement and rotation. It mimics celestial movements of the heavenly bodies. It's the principle of integration, dualism, and intermediation of opposing forces.
Okay. Yeah.
All that in a nickel, buy a cup of coffee.
All right. Well, how about How about we take a break right there? You know, before we go to break, again, check the links in the show notes for more information on this topic and where you can find the video or where you can find the audio, depending on where you're looking at this. And also in the show notes is Alan's website, where you can find a lot more of his resources. And we have a link to his Patreon, where you can support some of these efforts and help keep all this going. So with that, we will take a break and see you on the other side. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 107. And we are talking about an indexical symbol, Alan calls it, an encapsulated cross. So let's continue diving into this subject, Dr. Garfinkel.
Well, Professor Webster, one of the amazing things about this, with this indexical cross, this encircled cross, this symbol, is that it's associated with what's called the New Fire Ceremony. The New Fire Ceremony is a ceremony that is associated with the snake dance of the Hopi. It's also associated with the famous Aztec Winter Solstice Festival, where they actually see in shadow the snake crawling up the side of the pyramid as well. Now, what's also amazing is I believe that I see depicted in Coso, in Little Petroglyph Canyon, a panel that also bears the indication of this new fire ceremony. It's what I might call as a meta-narrative. It's a time of renewal, reinauguration of the sun. And in each of these situations, there's a creation narrative. So I mentioned the creation narrative of the Aztecs. There's also a creation narrative of a sun story for the Huichol. The Huichol are indigenous people that have kept their culture alive, very conservative people. They're famous for the pilgrimage to the garner peyote, which they call their grandmother. And they live in the very southernmost edge of Texas, but mainly North Mexico. So in the time before time, their ancestors abided in the underworld, which was located in the west. Time without form, divide of humankind, and shrouded in continuous night. The moon was the singular illumination. The primordial ancestors queried grandmother growth, Nakawe, what they must do so the sun would emerge. Decision was made so that one of the five pilgrims would perform what was called an auto-sacrifice. Four of the five attempted, but failed. But the fifth chose to cast himself into the fire, drop through five levels of the netherworld, battled ferocious beasts who attempted to kill and eat him. But after 5 days, he reached Dawn Mountain, burst forth through the cave door, and in doing so, was transformed into the Sun Father. Since his powers had been depleted, the sun could not rise high enough in the heavens, and it began to descend. The sun began to burn up and melt everything on earth. But the five ancestors reassembled to raise the heavens, and the four were placed in the corners of the cosmos, with one in the center, so the sun would now reside in its proper place. And that's the story of the Huichol. Very similar to that of the Aztecs as well.
Indeed.
As we continue, we have a picture on a pyramidal boulder in Little Petroglyph Canyon. And here's our five primordial pilgrims with their hands up in the air, holding something that looks like a parachute. And I think it's a cloud. And then in the center of their circle is another figure holding the snakes. And above, and it's above a lunar crescent moon. So these, it's what I call the sky bearer and the origin of the sun panel. And this would date to maybe about, say 2000 BC, about 4,000 years ago. So what we see in this picture, the number five is a very significant number to the Aztecs and to the Nahuatl people, as well as the people, the Huichol. And it's meant as a symbol for man meeting God, God meeting man, divinity and transcendence, harmony and beauty, and the one true God. So harmonizing these opposites is one of the key metaphors of what's called this quinsunk, this quatrefoil, this Nahua Olin symbol. And it tries to intersect identify with compound metaphors embedding what's called the polysemous, the many meanings all in one. Heaven and earth, day and night, good and evil, morning and evening stars, which is Venus, man becoming God and God becoming man. Sound familiar?
Indeed, yeah.
So it's rather remarkable that this symbol can be so interconnected with so many various cultures and have so much impact and substance to it. So,
yeah, and similar meaning too.
Similar meanings. When you think about Jesus, you're thinking about the reincarnation, man becoming God, God becoming man. When you're thinking about resurrection and transformation, coming of age, the turning of the seasons, it's all interconnected. It's all interrelated. Yeah. And the more one thinks about this, the more sense it all makes. And especially for pre-contact or pre-literate societies, I just talked about this earlier, these people had a whole different association or understanding, vision, connection with the earth and the environment. And you know that, right?
Yeah.
How did that differ from the way we work today?
Well, I mean, not very many people today have any connection with anything outside of their, you know, their house and their job.
Right.
Yeah.
And when we're dealing with native people or dealing with this pre-contact civilization, all they knew was the land, the trees, the birds, the rocks.
Yeah.
It was all part and parcel of who they were and what they were and what they did and what they learned. And their culture, what I've learned in the small amount of time I've been on this planet, often native people, they don't talk much, okay? They don't, words are, you know, not that important to them. It's words, right? They're very fanciful. Mm-hmm. They're like wisps in the wind. They listen.
Right.
And the listening, the things they hear and the things they sense and feel are sometimes much more important than these fanciful words we think are so relevant. Do you agree? Hmm.
Indeed, I do. Yeah. I've actually, you know, as a founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network and an editor of most of the shows, one of the shows we have called Heritage Voices, actually, our host, Jesse Aquinto, she interviews a lot of Native Americans. And I got to say, you know, with a lot of people that I edit, I will take out like vocal crutches and pauses and things like that. It's more of a common thing for Native speakers, Native Americans speaking on a show like this, to have those longer pauses and really pick and choose the words that they're going to use rather than having more vocal crutches, I've noticed. So, yeah, I've just noticed that in podcast editing.
Yeah. And when you talk to Native people, they look at you and they wait. And they want to see what you're going to say and how you're going to say it and how do you look and how do you feel and what's your deal, you know? And then when you read their narratives, they emphasize the sounds and the feelings that are associated with a place. And when you go to these places, you hear things and see things and sense things. It's a drama. It's a transcendence. It's an overwhelming emotional experience.
Indeed.
Do you ever get that when you're there at a rock art site?
Yeah, but that I'm an archaeologist. I almost get that. I get that at lots of sites, you know, when you're trying to just put yourself in the moment, you know, and really kind of feel it. It's a really interesting experience, I guess. Yeah. You know, real quick, one thing I was thinking about with the, I guess, similar definitions of especially this encapsulated cross, similar meaning across cultures, really across the world in some cases. I'm sure we see that with other symbols that are of a more simple nature, right? Not your more complex ones. Those probably have a lot more complexity locally and regionally, but a lot of your more simple symbols that reflect nature and they reflect, you know, somewhat everyday circumstances. We must see those reflected in rock art across the planet and probably have similar meaning, although we can't really know what that is in most cases.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
We can, in a way, gather or garner, when looking at the images, ask oneself, what are we feeling? What are we sensing? What emotion does this bring out? Is it awe? Is it fear? Is it joy? Is it sadness? Is it a sense of connection with the supernatural or the divine? There's an image in Little Petroglyph Canyon where they have this creature, this, it looks like a woman perhaps, coming out of a crack in the rock, right? And it's surprising, it's abrupt, it's in some sense beautiful as well.
Nice.
And if you look very closely and move your head to the left and down, you will see a small figure with his hands holding them up to the sky as a supplicant. What's a supplicant, Alan? It's a it's an individual that is entreating this divine or this deity, this supernatural, for their aid and their help in overcoming the challenges of life.
Okay. Well, you know what? That sounds like a good point to take a break and then come back and wrap up this discussion on the other side. We'll be back in a minute. All right. Welcome back to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 107. And we are going to wrap up this discussion, not just about the encapsulated cross, but, you know, other symbols and their meaning and nature. So continue, please.
Yeah. So as I was mentioning earlier, if you look on baskets, and even if you look on the rocks themselves, this encapsulated cross has this fourfold or fivefold symbolism. And one of the ways it's represented is with this backwards swastika. You know, first time I saw that, it reared me, and I said, why am I seeing a swastika here in the Aboriginal way? And then I found out that, oh, before they came up with the swastika, the Indians had it, but it was going the other direction. Well, amongst the Kuia, Southern California Indians, this is known as the Wheel of Life.
Okay.
And it represents the four ages of man, woman. It's in constant motion. It has four arms, being birth, youth, maturity, and death. So that's rather interesting as well. Here it is.
That is.
On the baskets. Here it is for the Navajo. And here it is in Coso Rock Art. It's all over the place. It's also a symbol, one of the primary symbols, for the group of Indians in the eastern Mojave Desert who are agriculturalists, known as the Mojave or the Kitsan. The Mojave Indians were agriculturalists, and they also were very lean fighters. They were rather aggressive and warriors. And they also were the famous people who are called the Mojave Runners. What they did was they imported trade items from the American Southwest, and they would carry those on their backs running across the Mojave Desert from the Colorado River to the coast there amongst the Chumash.
Wow.
It'd take them about, I think, a week or 2 weeks to, and they kept running day and night, and they would get there, and they had cotton blankets, and they had other items along those lines, and then they would trade. But the major symbol that you see in the petroglyph sites of the Mojave, these are individuals who belong to a different ethno-linguistic affiliation, the humans, Y-U-M-A-N. They had this encapsulated or encircled cross, and it had a very special place in their cosmology, because what it represented was the morning and evening stars. Also the concept of resurrection and transmogrification and rebirth and all of this, because to them, their major deity, which was called Mastambo, and he was found etched on the ground with the geoglyphs on both sides of the Colorado Desert. This is the being that, of course, incorporated or employed the concept of resurrection in their creation narratives.
Okay.
So this was a central and important symbol for the folks of the Mojave. And it's one thing that's very distinctive and central and prominent in every rock art site you're going to see in the eastern Mojave Desert.
That's interesting. And, you know, something I was thinking about, because we had a little side chat going here between segments. You mentioned Spanish, and I've been using Duolingo for the last, well, I think it was 720 days this morning to do Spanish. Yes. Every day, a little bit, because I never took Spanish when I was younger. Right. And now my wife and I are going to go spend a month in Greece in October. And so I've kind of pivoted to Greek just to see what that's like. And it makes me wonder, you know, when you look at these symbols together, and especially learning the Greek, and, you know, Greek is one of the oldest continuously used languages in the world, right? I mean, it's just, it goes back almost 2,800 years. And you look at some of the symbols and the groups of letters that make up certain sounds that make up the words. You know, you put these groups together and they mean something as a whole. Well, something I've never thought about with rock art, really, and I'm sure you have and other rock art scholars, is something like this encapsulated cross. Is this often found in association with other stuff? Is it by itself? Can you commonly say, well, if I find this, then I know this is somewhere nearby? You know what I mean?
Let me speak to that in just a simple way. There's an image in the Cosos. It's in the Monster Canyon that I was telling you about. I always like it when there's something that I know what it is. So there's a Thunderbird motif. It's rather obvious. It's got wings outstretched, and it's there and looking right at you. And instead of a face, it has an encapsulated cross right there, front and center.
Wow.
Above the image, besides the Thunderbird looking right at you, the rain is coming down. It's got rain all around it. Of course, to those that don't know about the Thunderbird, that was a mythological animal, human spirit, bigger than the biggest bird that existed. And it brought on with its wings, it made the heavens rumble and roar with thunder and lightning and brought on the rain.
Wow.
And so there's a sight that I have never seen except in pictures that exists in Saline Valley, which is one of the valleys right near Death Valley, one of the driest places on Earth. Mm-hmm. And there's a white to gray to beige volcanic escarpment that goes on for many, many meters. And on that escarpment are eight huge examples of these wonderful eagle-like thunderbirds.
Wow.
And besides that, they've been depicted or placed so that when it rains, the rain spout, the rain drippings, goes right down the center of each of those images.
Wow.
And interspersed, interfingered with these images of the rain deity is fertility symbols, reproductive elements of females, and bighorn sheep copulating,
of course,
and all the rest, and it's all there. I mean, it's obviously about fertility and life and rebirth, and you know, exposed just there, so you can obviously grab onto it.
Wow.
I think that's why I like rock art so much. It's just, it's fun and it's interesting and endlessly engaging, because the more you think about it, almost the deeper you can get and the more connections and relationships and insights and epiphanies one can come to. Does that make any sense?
It does. And that's probably why, I mean, you start hearing the phrase rock art being used less and less, right? And in favor of like rock drawings or something else like that, right? Or just the actual archaeological definitions of pictograph or, you know, something like that. So, and part of that is because the word art implies something that may not be the intention. It's almost more of a language. It's more of a symbolic language, You know what I mean?
It is indeed.
Yeah.
That's the subject for another podcast. They just had a news item that shows that someone believes that they've decoded some of the oldest rock art as to what some of the recurrent symbols mean.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what. We can talk about that because we've got an episode of the Archaeotech podcast coming out tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
Talking about three news articles, all related to using AI to basically suss out something that humans are just not able to see. You know, one of them was new Nazca lines found in Peru.
Uh-huh.
Using training AI to look at images, and AI found, I mean, very obvious patterns where have been missed for 200 years. Using AI to read cuneiform tablets to translate them straight to English from Sumerian and Akkadian. And then, you know, using AI to do a number of things. So it wouldn't surprise me, you know, that we could use AI to find other shapes that we maybe didn't think were significant. But I'm not sure about the actual interpretation because we don't even know what they mean. You have to train the AI with something, right? So you have to teach it what you have to say. This symbol means this and this symbol means this. Find more of those and tell me what it all means. But if you don't know those starting points, it's hard to make it continue.
And in some ways, we do know what certain symbols mean, as though I've, you know, professed today.
Yeah.
And so if we go from the known to the unknown, which is sometimes called the ethnohistoric method or the ethnographic analogy.
Right.
I think we could be surprised at what we might learn or what better questions we might be asking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think the rocks can begin to speak. Talking stones, right?
Exactly. So, all right. Well, any final words on this topic before we end the show today?
I just think going to rock art sites and studying this subject is one that is endlessly engaging, very mysterious, and a heck of a lot of fun.
Indeed. Well said. All right. Well, with that, again, look down at your show notes, or if you're on YouTube, take a look at the notes for this video and check out Alan's website and Patreon. And he's got books. He mentioned Talking Stone, which is also a video that you can get. So check that out. And with that, we will see you guys next time with another great episode of the Rock Art Podcast. Thanks a lot.
See you next week on the Flip Flop Gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.